Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now, journalist, author, former Wall Street executive, and now historian, Nomi Prinz, a fierce critic of the finance industry in her first books. Prinz now looks at 100 years of relationships between bank presidents and presidents of the United States. Want to guess how the balance of power has shifted over time? Her book is called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. And spoiler alert, the last line of the book says, either we break the alliances or they will break us. Hi, Nomi. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
And we'll get to your call to action, but let's do some history first. Your book begins with a story from Black Thursday, the day before the 1929 stock market crash. Can you start with that story and how the Big Six bank presidents saw their responsibility to the nation at that time?
Yeah, there was a very dark cloud over the markets at the time. And what happened was Tom Lamont, who was the acting chair of the Morgan Bank, the big Morgan Bank, which is now part of J.P. Morgan Chase, so survived, called five of the top bankers of the day to come to his offices at 23 Wall Street and figure out how they would save the markets because they were on the hook as well as the markets were on the hook. And after only 20 minutes, they emerged, all this fanfare of the press and everything else. What are they going to say? What are they going to do? And said, we're all going to put in, well, they didn't say it, but they decided to all put in $25 million of their own money or their customers' money or some combination to go and buy stocks and prop up the market. Of course, that didn't work. Over the next several years, the market lost over 90% of its value. But on those days, it did work, and everybody exulted, and they decided to put their money where their speculation had been.
And you contrast that with a similar meeting in the teeth of the 2008 financial crisis. What was similar? What was different?
Fast forward, and in that crisis, the bankers were also getting together. Instead of it being noon, it was more closer to 12 o'clock at night, but sort of the same idea. But they were also with the Treasury Secretary and the head of the Feds. And in that situation, it was decided that the Fed would put in money and the Treasury Department would put in money, and banks would merge and acquire other banks so that they could remain stable and have more depositors' money with which to remain stable. So we went from a period where they sort of collaborated to try and save themselves to a period where they just willfully took the help of the government and the various entities thereof to do it for them.
And you go back even further to an even much less known than the 1929 stock market crash moment, the panic of 1907. So what happened then, and why do you think it affects the power of the banks to this day?
It was a fascinating panic, and I'd started the book from thinking about the 20s, and then I decided to go back further and look at the whole over 100 years because it was even more similar to what just happened recently in that there was one particular trust company. It was called the Knickerbocker Trust in New York City that was going under through bad bets in copper and sort of all these shady dealings, and J.P. Morgan at the time, the main banker in the country and arguably in our history, the most important, most powerful banker ever, got a bunch of people together in a room as well. That was at midnight at the Hotel Manhattan. And it was very sort of hush-hush, and all the big bankers came again. And the Treasury Secretary at the time, Teddy Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, was not allowed to be involved in this meeting. He was waiting for what they would say and what they would do in order to go in and save the markets. And the result again there was J.P. Morgan, earlier now than the Big Six in 1929, told every one of his friends to put in money. They did not save the Knickerbocker Trust because they were not friends with the people that ran the Knickerbocker Trust. They were friends with the people that ran the Trust Company of America. Not only were they friends, not only did they have family relationships, they had some of their own money on the line. So the parallel there was that they chose to save their friends, and that kind of established this set of alliances throughout the next 100 or so years where bankers save their own and their alliances with presidents enable the symbiotic connections between the two to save each other over many events, financial, military, and other, that came over the next 100 years.
But didn't the Federal Reserve Board, also grow out of that crisis?
Yes, absolutely. J.P. Morgan again, he was not at this meeting, but there was a meeting at Jekyll Island in 1910. And it was because the bankers decided, on one hand, that they didn't want to have to put up their own money and have these midnight meetings. They'd rather just have someone else do it for them in the shape of a central bank for the United States. And politically, both President Taft, who then came into power, and after that, President Wilson, a Republican and a Democrat, came in and also wanted the same thing in different ways. And the meeting that took place at Jekyll Island was called by a senator, the head of the Finance Committee, Nelson Aldrich, but it was attended by bankers that were representatives of the Morgan Constellation. In order to even get to Jekyll Island, you had to be a member. None of those people were members. They used a guest pass back in the day that was put up by J.P. Morgan, which I discovered when I went to Jekyll Island to look at these archives, in order to get there and create this idea that became the Fed 3 years later.
And the biggest critics of the Federal Reserve today, I think, tend to be the ultra-libertarians like Ron and Rand Paul. Progressives have mostly cheered how Ben Bernanke took the stimulus measures that he could the last few years when the Republicans in Congress refused. So how, in your opinion, should Americans think of the Fed?
It's interesting that it's only the libertarians that have criticizing discussions about the Fed, because progressives really should, too. It really depends what you believe the Fed is doing. If you believe that putting $4.5 trillion of debt buying on your books in order to save the banks and give them 0% interest rates with which to get cheap money, with which to speculate more, is positive for the American people, then you think what the Fed is doing is a good idea. The reality is the Fed was not conspiratorial, but actually created by bankers to save the banking system, and that has been its function, along with interest rate maneuvers, but that has been its function since day one.
Were you cheering for Ben Bernanke and all his, quantitative easing to, pump up the stock market, but with the goal of, keeping unemployment as low as possible and stuff like that, or not really?
I think the idea of keeping unemployment low is something that the Fed has used particularly recently because it sounds good publicly. The reality is the Fed doesn't create job fairs. What it does is manipulate money and provide bankers subsidies in the form of trillions of dollars of buying their bonds to get them off their books so they can do other things, and keeping rates low for them. And that really doesn't create jobs. It's a nice rhetoric, but it really isn't the function.
Noemi Prinz, our guest. She's a senior fellow at the progressive think tank Demos and now the author of All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. It's a history of 100 years of relationships between presidents of banks and presidents of the United States. And at the heart of your book, I'd say, is the concept that you were getting at before, how the relationships between bank presidents and presidents of the United States have changed, and the implications for the rest of us. And part of that is that from the 1930s to the 1960s, the bankers who most influenced presidents were on close personal terms with them, you write. So can you give us an example and how that close personal relationship affected the public?
Yeah, well, at first they were close before that, but a little bit more, much more self-serving. And in that period of the 30s through the 60s, and it really started with FDR, and he was friends, hung out, went to yachting expeditions with these people. Him and the two heads of Chase Bank, who was Winthrop Aldrich, who was actually the son of Nelson Aldrich, the father of the Fed, and James Perkins, who was head of National City Bank, which became Citigroup. So big bankers, two of the biggest bankers at the time, helped FDR to pass the Glass-Steagall Act. They met with him. Winthrop Aldrich was in and out of Washington to try and get senators to make that thing more regulatory than even Senator Carter Glass wanted to make it. And as a result, we had this greater stability into the banking system, which helped ultimately the overall stability economically and financially of the American public. And then after that, World War II happened, and some of the same bankers were involved in financing some of the war efforts and also continuing to not so much speculate. I mean, they were certainly lending towards allies and so forth, but they kept the stability of the economic markets at home somewhat safe. And they worked with Truman, and they worked with Eisenhower, and they worked with LBJ to fashion what was good for them and what was better for the country at the same time. They could walk and chew gum at the same time.
But then you write, by the 1970s, bankers like David Rockefeller and Citibank chief Walter Wriston were pushing Presidents Nixon and Carter to do their bidding for them without the authentic personal ties of the past. What happened to those ties? Was it that presidents were coming less from the aristocracy than, say, FDR did?
There was a little of that. In Nixon's case, the relationship, and he certainly knew Rockefeller. He offered him a position as Treasury Secretary, which Rockefeller refused because Nixon did not ask him personally. He sent one of his guys to ask David, and that just annoyed him. But also, equally, Nixon wouldn't take his visits to the same extent that, say, LBJ had. So certain things started to devolve, even though the power influence was still high. But then bankers discovered oil. They discovered the Middle East. They discovered that they could be apart from whatever the national policy or national public interest might be, and find their own sources of expansion and money, and they could utilize that. They could recycle the petrodollars, profits coming from the Middle East into Latin America, and expand there and create debt there. And that devolved into a situation where Latin America then had a third world debt crisis, and Ronald Reagan's team and then Bush's team saved them. Now they were saving the banks again, and the banks weren't giving them anything in return. So they still talked to each other and had personal relationships, but the idea of connecting on a basis of anything sort of positive was disintegrated.
And you're right that the role of the big bankers became more selfish. You used that word. Do you mean less patriotic in a sense?
It looks less patriotic as well, because. And we could look at bankers as always being sort of greedy and selfish and all of that, and that story sort of gets done. But there are sort of shades of gray in between. And the more selfish and the more greedy and the less patriotic and the less nationalistic they became, that had dire consequences for the rest of the population here as well as for the world. And it had dire consequences for how government bailed out banks starting in the 80s and going forward until what we saw recently.
And then ideology creeps into it. You're right about President Reagan naming Wriston, the Citibank president, chair of the president's economic advisory board in 1982 while he was still holding his job as president of Citibank. And you're right that Wriston conflated a libertarian view of individual freedoms with an argument for deregulating the banks. What was that conflation and with what effect?
Well, the idea is that he extended this notion of personal freedom and personal democracy into banks being sort of persons who required no rules. And he was
just like the Supreme Court ruling last week.
Exactly. And that was just a remanifestation at that arm of the government as well. But that Wriston was really one of the big pushers before even Sandy Weill ran Citibank, or basically what became Citigroup after that, to really push for deregulation. And under Reagan, it was really Bush's task force. Bush had a task force that he created for a sole purpose of deregulating the financial industry, and mostly these big banks. You know, when I say industry, I really mean these big six banks and whoever was at the head of them. So it was Wriston and, again, to a lesser extent, Rockefeller, because he was off gallivanting around the world creating Chases.
And by the time Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush appointed Goldman Sachs presidents as their Treasury Secretaries, Robert Rubin and Henry Paulson, respectively, you write that campaign donations had taken the place of discourse in defining the relationships. But didn't Clinton like and trust Robert Rubin? He didn't just buy his way to Treasury Secretary, did he?
No, although Robert Rubin was one of the people initially who helped Clinton gain legitimacy on Wall Street. So one of the things that even catapulted Clinton into having meetings around Wall Street that enabled him to not just get money in these $1,000 plate dinners and so forth throughout, but also to gain this sort of camaraderie, which he didn't have because he came from outside of that world. And Rubin and others actually at Goldman and friends of theirs and clients of theirs were able to provide that to Clinton. So he sort of adopted it.
This was part of Clinton being a new Democrat, right? This is part of why Clinton got elected in the first place and was able to become the first Democratic president since, I guess, George McGovern gave the party an ultra-liberal bad name, because he was doing business with the bankers. He was doing business with the idea of free trade, as well as some other issues.
Right. They made him. In the 1994 situation that happened with NAFTA and then the Mexican peso crisis, I mean, that was another bailout of Goldman and others who had exposure to Mexico. And Robert Rubin had, another late night meeting with Larry Summers and so forth in Clinton's White House to discuss what they would do there. But Clinton in his memoirs talks about how he believed in what Robert Rubin believed in. There's a quote that I have in my book from his memoirs that very much captures that. So he was made by Wall Street and he gave back in return.
I think you seem to reserve a special place in purgatory for Robert Rubin as a Democratic deregulator. And you're very tough on the 1990s repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had kept so-called regular banks from doing Wall Street-type investments and taking Wall Street-type risks. Why do you think that matters so much?
Well, yeah, first of all, yes, Robert Rubin was the one that was, well, he was there until 10 minutes before when he wasn't there, and Larry Summers came in and that act was actually signed, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, the Gramm-Leach-Biley Act. But it's important because everything that led up to the crash in 1929, everything that led up to this idea that you could have depositors' money, you could have the taxpayers' backing, you know, after that, and that would give you the risk ability to do whatever you want from a speculative capacity. And today it's so much worse than then. We have, you know, we have a several hundred trillion dollar derivatives market, of which the top six U.S. banks control 96% of the derivatives in the United States and 45% in the world. These are very powerful amounts of capital. And all that capital is tied into our deposits. They also control 85%, the top six banks today, 85% of all the commercial bank deposits in the country. And those are all backed by the FDIC. So the position that they're in right now is so much more dangerous than it was back then. And that's why the full-on repeal, and it had been going on through Reagan and Bush in pieces, actually even through Carter a little bit in pieces, but the full repeal made that connection of risk to everything that we own and we have in these banks so much more crucial.
You don't think that Wall Street firms would have been as likely to crash the housing market or contribute to the crash with credit default swaps and all that, that the too clever by half securitization of mortgages, all of that would have taken place even without ownership ties to regular banks and all that concentration?
It was certainly happening outside of banks. You know, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were not owners of deposits into that situation.
Insurance companies were doing it.
Insurance companies were buying it. So there's definitely a collusion across of this. And this is what Louis Brandeis back in 1910 warned of in Other People's Money when he was talking to Woodrow Wilson at the time, was that, you know, this idea of money trust, of the insurance and the banks and all of this sort of collaboration of using other people's money to take on risk and to proliferate risk and to make profits out of that was really dangerous to America. And we saw that in 29, we saw that in 2008, a lot of places in between. So it remains a danger. And the banks that didn't have FDIC backing into that period and still have relationships with insurance and everything else got it from the Fed in 2008 in the fall so that they now have that extra tie to federal resources should they need them.
Huh. I said at the beginning, I gave the listeners a spoiler alert at the beginning and read the last line of your book, which is a stark call to action. It says, either we break the alliances or they will break us. What would breaking the alliances look like?
That is a very tough question. That might be something we see in the next 100 years. But it certainly means realizing that the political and financial power that is joined at the hip has such a dangerous quality. And looking back 100 years ago when Brandeis said that, except he said, you know, again, we should break the money trust before they break us. You know, breaking it means breaking up these banks, it means sort of reducing the power. It means not having the decision that was just made at the Supreme Court with respect to personalizing contributions again. It's not something any one of us can do individually, but it's something we should be all aware of so we can consider talking about it collectively. There was a groundswell of collective talk that enabled FDR to do what he did in 1933 and the bankers to be on board and also to do something that was stabilizing for the population. At the least, we should be pushing for that.
You used to be a Wall Street executive. Did your view of the banks become this cynical because of your experience or in spite of it?
A little bit of both. I think I realized as I was leaving just how bad things had gotten while I was there. And when you're inside and you're trading and you're pressured by all your bosses to make all this money and you're a part of that world, you question things possibly along the way, but there's not enough time in the day to really do something about or analyzing, which is why I quit to write. And I think that since then, this perspective I've gotten through writing this book in particular, and I've written a number of books. We've talked about them here on your show. But this one in particular really enabled me to go to the presidential libraries, to look at the archives, to really, really analyze with my experience what was happening at the core of these relationships of 19 presidents, from Theodore Roosevelt to Obama, with bankers over time and what it really says about us as a country and where we go from here.
100 years of history and contemporary analysis in the new book, All the President's Bankers, the Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. And Nomi Prinz will do a book signing tomorrow night at 7, barely a mile from Wall Street, at the Strand, Broadway and 12th Street in the East Village, tomorrow night at 7 at the Strand. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, to wrap up the show today, David Letterman, Life After Letterman. Why is the comedian-hosted talk show the universal formula for late-night television anyway? And why are half of them white guys named Jimmy? We'll try to answer that question. Stay with us.